Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Welcome. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Preeta, and I will be your host this morning for our weekly Global Awakening Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. Today, our special guest is none other than Ken Cloke, who is someone who can not only speak to, but also embodies today's theme of from conflict to transcendence and transformation. In just a few minutes, our moderator, Alyssa Martin, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Ken Cloke. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a period of audience reflections, Q&A, and circle of sharing. So with that, I will pass it over to Alyssa.
Great. Thank you, Preeta. I appreciate that. I'm so pleased to be having this conversation today with Ken, who's really an amazing individual. A little bit of background on Ken. As a director of the Center for Conflict Resolution, Ken has extensive experience in mediation, negotiation, and resolution of complex organizational, interpersonal, and public policy disputes. Before he got his start in mediation, though, Ken, who's a graduate of UC Berkeley, was actively involved in the civil rights movement. It was there that Ken began to realize that perhaps a different approach to conflict and conflict resolution was needed. Ken then worked as an administrative law judge and judge for the municipal and superior courts in LA for a period of time. In those capacities, he started to have more exposure to mediation and other forms of dispute resolution, which for him opened up new collaborative, heart-based ways of approaching conflict, as opposed to the sort of more rules-based, head-based approach that characterizes our traditional adversarial system. Ken then dedicated his life to mediation and other forms of non-adversarial conflict resolution. And his approach to mediation and conflict resolution, which I'm sure we'll talk about in this call, is quite remarkable. Ken sees conflict, whether it's at an individual or at a societal level, as an opportunity for transcendence and transformation. And Ken sees conflict as having many dimensions, including emotional, energetic, and spiritual dimensions. With regard to the mediator, Ken does not think of conflict as something external to the mediator or something in which the mediator has to intervene. Rather, Ken tells mediators, in a quote, to recognize that everything the parties do or experience in conflict already exists inside you, along with everything they need to know, feel, and learn to resolve their disputes. Therefore, you are the technique, and your capacity for empathy, awareness, and calming presence will resonate inside them, eliciting qualitatively different outcomes. So as I mentioned, Ken is a renowned figure in the field of dispute resolution. He is president and co-founder of Mediators Beyond Borders, which is an organization that focuses on resolving systemic conflicts, and he's a prolific author and speaker on the subject. On a personal note, I highly recommend his book, Mediating Dangerously, The Frontiers of Conflict Resolution. It was a really transformative read for me. So with that, we can start our conversation. Thank you, Ken, so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alyssa. Thank you for inviting me.
Wonderful. So I thought we would kind of start out talking about this pretty profound shift in your life when you kind of transitioned away from some of the more traditional legal roles. I was wondering if you could tell me a bit more about what catalyzed that shift, and in particular, I'm curious about the shift in your thinking about conflict. How did you kind of come to realize that conflict isn't simply some external phenomenon or something that's something to just get past?
Well, I think in the first place, every one of us has many, many experiences with conflict going back to the time that we were infants. To the time when we were in school, when our parents didn't understand us, when we found ourselves at odds with people that we felt attached to or had strong feelings for. And I think that incipient sense of being out of sorts, not being, having conflict, not feel like it is either comfortable or natural or conducive to learning, is something that all of us can understand and relate to. The more difficult realization comes when you figure out that the conflict is actually inside of you. The one that you hate is inside you. And hatred becomes then a vibration, a kind of soup, if you will, in which you are immersed. And that you have a choice in how to handle it. The choice isn't immediately obvious because it's being made by the limbic system inside your brain that has recognized some threat that perhaps feels assaulted or insulted and responds kind of in a very primitive manner without realizing that what we are basically confronting is a lack of skill. So the very first skill that it turns out that we need to learn in order to handle our conflicts differently is a very simple one, which is simply, are we going to engage in the conflict and behave badly? Or are we going to try to stop and try to figure out what's actually going on here? And I think that experience also is one that all of us know and recognize, even from childhood. It's especially important in families because families are simultaneously sort of cauldrons of conflict and at the same time centers of deep, profound, positive emotional connection. At least we hope that they are that. We want them to be that. And the question then becomes, how do we exactly handle this? Well, we often handle it just through time, the passage of time. We get upset. We storm off. We cry. Pout, whatever it is, but time passes, and we then return to a kind of non-conflict state, but without having learned very much, except perhaps to count to 10. More advanced skills come later in our lives. Particularly, they come in relationship to our friends, to our peer groups, where we experience a variety of different conflicts, with our girlfriends and boyfriends, the people we love and admire in our lives. For me, there was a kind of third place that conflict came from, which you alluded to in your introduction, which was out of the experience of social conflict. And with each of these experiences, in the first place, conflict felt overwhelming, very difficult to handle in any kind of skillful way. But with experience, what I began to realize is that counting from 1 to 10 is pretty basic, and that more fundamental, much more skillful than that, is asking your opponent a question that could reveal where this conflict came from them as well as for you. And those skills continue. So I've just mentioned the first couple. I think there are an infinite number of those. And throughout our lives, we pick up first this one and then that one, and one turns out to be useful and another one turns out, even the same one may turn out not to be useful in some different circumstance or situation. And it's exactly the same in mediation. The very thing that you do that works miraculously with someone at 9:05 completely falls apart at 9:10. So what is conflict then really? Well, I think we can think of it simply as a place where we're stuck. And the reason that we're stuck is because we don't have the skills to be able to handle it at some higher level. And each of those skills is a kind of transformation. That is, it is a change in the form of the conflict. Once we exercise those skills, the conflict itself changes. And we become unstuck at that level of conflict by exercising those skills. But those skills will get us a certain distance and no further. So if two kids are playing on a playground, the very first, and they're fighting, the very first thing that we tend to do is to separate them. And separation is a useful thing to do. It stops the fighting. But if the kids are going to talk about why they're getting into conflict with each other, they have to actually do more than be separated. They have to actually come together. So separation works to stop the fighting, but it doesn't work to settle the issues that they're fighting over. So in that way, we can see that there are relatively primitive and relatively advanced methods for handling any particular type of conflict, and those are endless. So throughout our lives, we have nothing but opportunities for transcendence. Nothing but opportunities for transformation, to change the form of the thing. And by changing it, we learn from it and discover some higher order of capacity to come to terms with the thing that was giving us the most trouble. So that's a bit of a long explanation. I don't know if that's exactly what you were looking for. But that's yeah, go ahead.
That's a wonderful starting point. There's so much there that I want to kind of follow up on, which there's a lot of different avenues. One thing that struck me in your response was you mentioned just thinking about kind of the mediator in this. You mentioned that the conflict exists inside you. It's inside each of the parties. It's inside the mediator, and you know, what a mediator does at 9:05 may not be appropriate at 9:10. You know, you have to be attuned to really present in the conflict and attuned to the vibratory qualities, as you say. And so I was wondering if you could maybe give us some examples of, in your mediation practice, of when your presence, your kind of ability to stay attuned to the vibratory qualities of conflict elicited different outcomes.
Sure. Let me give you a little bit of a, how do I say this, a theoretical justification for what I'm about to say. Basically, the kinds of conflicts that we are thinking about are conflicts between human beings. And this is a place now where we can begin to see that there is a connection between conflict resolution and some very core spiritual ideas, particularly Buddhist ideas about human suffering. The first of those ideas is impermanence, and the second of those ideas is that one of the sources of suffering is attachment. But if we think about this for just a moment, we can see that as living beings, we have life energy flowing inside of us. And the natural state of that life energy is flow. So any obstacle that's placed in the path of that flow is going to create a distortion. And if we go back to what I said before, that conflict is a state of being stuck means that we have created a diversion of our own life energy. And it's now flowing in some different direction. It's blocked from its natural state. And so what happens in mediation, to get back to your question, is that using empathy and storytelling and a variety of different techniques, what I basically try to do is to feel their energy flowing inside of me. The energy, and to find the place where that energy has become knotted, where it's obstructed, where there's some barrier, to feel the place where all of a sudden there's depth, unexpected depth, where there's, for example, a power word that someone will use, a word that has immense energy attached to it. The example that I would like to give is an example that actually comes from a mediation between kids that I did many years ago when I was helping to create school mediation programs. And this is one in which two girls were talking, and one of them, they had been friends, and one of them accused the other one of having taken something that she had said in confidence and shared it with other people. And I asked her how that felt to her, and she said, it was really upsetting, and I was very angry. Well, inside of me, I can feel very upsetting, and I can feel very angry, but that doesn't really feel 100% like what it actually felt like. And so I find the place in me where I might have experienced something like that, and I think of what words I would use to describe that. And the one word that describes that, the one word that has emotional power, is the word betrayed. And so I ask her, did you feel betrayed? And immediately there was a release of tension and a recognition, deep recognition of the truth of this. So then I have to ask myself the question, and that was the thing that turned the corner in the conversation. But I need to ask myself the question, why was it so difficult for her to come up with the word betrayed? And the answer, of course, is that the word betrayed betrays her, meaning the word betrayal consists both of disappointment and of desire. And it's the desire piece, the place that is most tender inside of her, the place where she is most vulnerable to disappointment. The place where she wants the other girl to really like her and keep her confidences so that she can feel a sense of intimacy and connection with her. That's the place that has been damaged, that's in trauma. And so what I began to realize is that it's always the most tender places inside of us that are the most hurt. And it's always the very first thing that we do in conflict to protect those places, to distance ourselves even from forms of conversation that would require us to become vulnerable in the presence of someone we no longer trust. And yet, there is at the same time a desire for release from suffering. There is a desire for honesty, for communication. There's a desire for connection, a hope that the other person will actually treat your confidence, that is, the vulnerable parts of you, with the care that they deserve. And so that opens up the possibility of a very, very different conversation between these two girls. And so I turned to the other girl and I said, was it your intention to betray her? And she said, no. And she started to say, why not? And I stopped her and I said, don't tell me, tell her. And now the two girls are talking to each other and they're both being open-hearted and honest and vulnerable with each other. And she apologizes for what she did in a very sincere way. And recognizes the pain that her friend had experienced. Now, this isn't going to be what's going to happen in every case, but the point of the conversation was to make it possible for them to have this deeper understanding of the source of their conflict. And the only way that could happen was by finding within myself what it must have felt like for her And when I say must, what I really mean is not as a statement, but as a question to her to find out, did you feel betrayed? And so in a very similar type of way, in every conflict, every conflict conversation, we're defending ourselves against the very thing that we want the most, against a heart-to-heart conversation with a person who has hurt us. And it's natural for us to want to avoid that conversation because they have, in fact, betrayed our trust somehow, because they haven't met our expectations, because we don't know any longer who they are or believe that they don't know who we are, and therefore we don't show them who we actually are. We shut down internally inside, and that creates a source of suffering because it's a kind of attachment. And it's even worse because it's an attachment to something that is over, that has already happened. And by being attached to that thing that is over, we keep it with us in our lives. It becomes a source of personality, just as the flow of a river, when it's blocked by some geological formation, by a rock, will be distorted and will take some new form. And in exactly that way, our lives are formed, not just by the conflicts that we've experienced, but by the ones we have not resolved, and even by the ways that we resolve the ones that we continue to have.
Wow, that's a very powerful example. I'm really struck by that. The betrayed betrays her. I mean,
there are thousands of examples like that I can give you, because in virtually every conflict, there's some little wounded place inside us that is searching for release. There's a wonderful little poem by Rumi who says, there is some kiss we want so badly that we would die for it.
Right.
And we die a little bit inside when we don't receive it.
Hmm. Yeah, this is all really reminding me of, actually, there's a part in your book, Mediating Dangerously, where you talk about every mediator at some point encounters a party whose problems reflect his or her own incomplete issues from the past, issues that require resolution. And, you know, those moments where the mediator can, you know, maybe work through some of his or her own issues or gifts that provide unique opportunities to learn from. And I'm wondering if you have any, if you could talk to that, if you could speak to any gifts that you, of that kind that you might have received.
Thank you. Well, let me say two things. First, an example. A very simple way of thinking of this, and I like to give simple examples because people can recognize them very easily. Babies, when they are very young, don't play with each other. They engage in what's called parallel play. That is, they play side by side. And if one baby is playing with a toy and the other baby takes it, there's no conflict, because the baby hardly even knows that the toy has disappeared. But at a certain point, as the babies develop, they become conscious of each other and begin to transition into parallel play. But in order to make the transition into parallel play, they have to figure out what to do when the other baby takes the toy and doesn't give it back. And that's a skill that is acquired. And it's acquired in part because of the desire for a relationship, and in part because of the fact that you do not yet have the skills to handle that relationship, to make it work. So every conflict those babies experience is experienced in the transition from parallel play into cooperative play. And it's the same with us. We're still in that transition from parallel play to cooperative play. We haven't really learned it completely. But as we acquire the skill to say, excuse me, can you pass the toy back, please? And I'd like to play with you, and if you'll pass the toy to me, I'll pass it back to you, and we can have some fun here. And that's the basic skill that we are looking for in terms of that transition. So here's what it means. It means every conflict in our lives takes place at a crossroads that is defined on the one hand by a problem we are now required to solve in order to grow and develop and meet the, you know, the requirements of the sort of the life that we have created or that we have found, and on the other hand by the fact that we do not yet have the skills we need in order to solve it. But when we acquire those skills, it's not that we actually resolve the conflicts on the playground with the kids that we fought with, it's that we outgrow them. We no longer experience those conflicts at all because we have transcended the source of the conflict by the development of skills that are adequate to that form of conflict. That doesn't mean they're going to be adequate to all forms of conflict. So I think that what we get in life is just an endless series of conflicts that require higher order skills. This is a little bit, for some of your listeners, they can think of this in kind of as being like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where the conflicts that you get when you're in survival mode are pretty primitive. But the conflicts you're going to get when you move into self-actualization, into art, those are significantly different conflicts. And we are defined in part by the conflicts that we experience and in part by our attitude toward those conflicts. So that once we see that every conflict is a kind of learning experience, it's a little arrow pointing directly at what we most need to learn in order to move on to higher order conflicts, then it becomes something different. And if we think about why it is, for example, that people get into dissatisfying relationships with other people, and then they break up, and then they meet the same type of person again and get into the same type of conflict over once again. I think the reason for that is because we just haven't learned the core skill, which is not one which is only external, it's internal as well. Because the ability to stop and say, wait a minute, here's what I experienced. What did you experience? In this conflict, even though you're my opponent, I need to find out what happened to you, because that is the place where my deepest learning is going to take place. Because truthfully, it's all about relationship between self and other. Every conflict, every resolution is somehow connected to who are you, and who is this other person, and who are they to you, and who are you to them, and how deeply can you imagine what it might be like to experience what they have experienced, and turn that into a form of growth and learning. I guess I was going to give you another, there was a second point, if I have time for this, or did you want to move on?
Of course. No, please continue.
The second was just a story, and you reminded me of this when we talked earlier, when you were letting me know what the call was going to be like. I did a mediation involving a woman who was the had been the head of the teachers' union in a school for 20 years. And was a very strong, powerful leader in the teachers' union, who had fought for the various teachers in her school for many, many years, and then stepped down and returned to the classroom. And as soon as she did, the problems began to occur. And she began getting into arguments with the other teachers and shouting and yelling at them and using not just your average swear words, but your world-class swear words in front of the children. and these were elementary school kids. So this was, the principal was getting ready to fire her because this had now happened on four different occasions, exactly the same thing. And so I brought, they decided to try mediation, so I brought them all together, and I asked the four teachers who were there to say what had happened to them individually, and with each one she said, no, that isn't what happened, and they're the ones who started it, and it wasn't my fault, et cetera, et cetera. And I could see this was just going nowhere. And so what I did was I went again inside myself, and I said, what would have happened to me? What would have had to have happened to me to make me act like that? And then what came up for me wasn't an answer, but a question, because we can't really know exactly what happened to another person, but we can ask questions to get deeper into that place. And so I stopped her in the middle of a sentence, and I said, excuse me, can I ask you a question? And she was a little shocked, and because she was on a roll, and said, okay. So I said, has anyone in this school ever thanked you for what you have done for them? And she just started to, she just burst into tears, sobbing uncontrollably. And the other teachers were just stunned because they had never seen her even blink in the face of opposition. And to now see her just dissolve in tears was just completely shocking to them. And so I stopped the conversation and I said, instead of telling her all the things that she has done wrong, I'd like you instead to thank her for what she has done for this school. Say one thing that she did that's made a difference for you in terms of your life. And they began describing these things, and now they're all starting to cry. And immediately, she fesses up to the whole thing. She says, I'm so sorry for what I did. She admits every single thing, apologizes profusely for it, and we have this really powerful, intense, heartfelt conversation. At the end of which I say, okay, to the teachers who are there, are we done yet? Does this feel like it's a resolution to you? And she stops me and says, no, I'm not done yet. And I think, oh, dear, what's going on now? And she says, I need to go to the parents and the other teachers and apologize for what I did. And the other teachers say, we're going with you. And instead of you just apologizing, we need to apologize too, because we knew that for 20 years you had been out of the classroom, and this must have been incredibly difficult for you to come back into a classroom after all that time, and we knew that, and we didn't help you, and we need to apologize for that. And so you can just imagine what the faculty meeting was like and what the parents' meeting was like when the teacher, when these teachers came forward and did this, made these statements. And it was just incredibly transformational. How come? Because instead of just defending herself against all these charges, what she did was to realize that there was a place now that she could go to that was really the truth. It was deeper, way deeper than the conflict, which was her own internal conflict and her sense of guilt and incapacity, her anxiety about not being able to handle the situations in the classroom with all these kids that before she had been able to handle. So that's an example, I think, of what you're talking about, where the conflict just all of a sudden, right around the corner, no more than a hair's breadth away, was some deep, profound realization that led to incredible growth and learning on everybody's part, because they all got to see the role that they had played in having this continue. Is that, did I
answer your question? Yeah, that's a really powerful, powerful.
Yeah. Hello?
Oh, I think Alyssa's probably going to have to dial back in. But Ken,
I'm sorry, here I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Ken. Yes. Ken.
Yes.
I think Alyssa accidentally must have dropped off.
I see. Okay, great.
Yeah, she'll dial back in a second. This is Prida.
Hi, Prida.
Powerful story you have. And I wonder if you can, you know, I'm really struck by what you said earlier about how all of us in our lives will be confronted with an endless kind of array of conflicts that increasingly draw upon us to develop skills of transcendence and transformation. And you obviously have through your practice of actually helping people through individual conflicts, see that and are confronted by that and have an opportunity to help people develop some of those skills. I'm wondering, is there a way, this is such an incredibly important learning societally for people. Is there a way to get that out there so that people can transform their own approach and relationship and views of conflict in a way that's not just one-off conflict by conflict, person by person?
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure you've explored that in your own work, but I'm just curious.
I'm busily exploring it right now, actually. First, let me say that one of the most interesting aspects of conflict is that it is self-similar on multiple scales. This is the scientific description of a fractal. A fractal is something that is self-similar on large and small scales. So what is true oftentimes between individual people may also be true of societies that can also develop higher order skills in handling conflicts. So in the United States today, we are experiencing intense political conflicts as a result of the recent election and as a result of a series of problems that haven't been adequately addressed. And the question becomes, how do we learn some skills to be able to manage that?
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I think that there are certain core skills. One of those is dialogue, without which we can say that democracy is limited. So the greater the skills in dialogue, the more opportunity there is for democracy to work and to deepen its creative possibilities. One of the things that I've done in recent years, actually for a little bit longer than that, is to bring people together who disagree with each other over a variety of different issues and help them figure out how to talk to each other, how to learn from each other, how to problem solve together. And at the simplest possible level, we can think of politics just as a form of social problem solving. And if we do that, then we can ask the question, what would make problem solving more effective on a social level? And clearly one of those things is being able to talk about social problems with each other, not only even, but especially when we have disagreements. So, for example, with Mediators Beyond Borders, the group that Alyssa mentioned before, I and a group of other people have been went for about 4 or 5 years, once a year to Athens to train Greek mediators in how to conduct dialogues between Greek citizens and immigrants. And that's a hot issue, and one that people have very hot opinions about. I'm sorry, did you want to say something? Did you want to jump in?
No, please. I would just respond. Please.
So the question is, how do you do that? And the first thing that we did was to ask a series of questions that help people understand each other. Here are two of those questions. One, have you ever in your life, this is to everybody who's present, either in a family or a neighborhood or a school or a workplace, been the new one and everybody else has been there for a while, and you've just come into this place. What did it feel like? How did they treat you? You know, how did it feel to not know what the rules were, to be seen as an outsider, as opposed to insiders? What emotions occurred? What resentments came up for you? How did you handle them? And have you ever, in your life, in a family or a school or a neighborhood or a workplace, been the one who's been there for a while? And now these new people are coming in, younger generation, people who have a different skin color, men, women, whatever it might happen to be. And how did that feel, to have these new people with different ideas coming in? Did you feel like, you know, what you believed in was going to be overwhelmed and or disregarded or not respected? How did you feel? And then within two questions, basically, everybody can start to understand what it feels like to be in the other one's shoes. And then we can begin to talk about what real life experiences people have had. And we don't want to then deny that there are problems, because that doesn't serve anything. What we want to do instead is to explore those problems together, to understand each other's problems and to solve them together. So I'm hoping that's partly an answer to your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. I'm going to turn it back over to Alyssa.
Okay, great. Thank
Hi, I'm,
you.
I'm sorry, everyone. My call must have dropped. I apologize for that. And I'm glad I was able to get back on quickly and hear your answer to that question. So one thing that occurred to me, Ken, and I don't know precisely when my call dropped, but I was going to ask you, you know, in the example you gave with the teachers, you know, there was resolution and it seemed great, and it seemed like you were getting kind of true justice there. But, you know, in some contexts, I think you've noted in your book, Mediating Dangerously, we have to be careful because we don't want to suppress conflict and trade justice for harmony. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's something that I've been thinking about a lot, because in my own personal life, I feel like I sometimes tend to be a bit of a conflict suppressor or avoider, and, you know, opt for the more temporary peace. And so I was wondering if you could speak to that and, you know, please tell us if
sure.
you have any examples of when you thought maybe it's best if the conflict persisted or maybe even increased.
Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you, Alyssa. First, let me say that I've written a little bit more about this. Some of it is in Mediating Dangerously, but I also wrote a book 2 years ago called The Dance of Opposites. And there's a chapter on mediation, law, and justice. And the statement that you made about trading justice for harmony, that comes from Laura Nader, a social anthropologist who is Ralph Nader's sister. And I think it's a valid critique that if we are trading justice for harmony with just for peace for peace's sake, and we haven't dealt with the underlying problems, we might do that for some tactical reason because the possibility of war is so great. But fundamentally, real peace comes with justice. So now we have to ask, what is justice? Aristotle defined justice as what he called a species of sort of something that's due proportion, meaning too much reward isn't just and too little reward. Too much punishment isn't just and too little punishment isn't just. So it has the punishment and the reward has to be proportionate. And how do we know that? And he said that in a sense, justice is someone else's self-interest. But the truth is, it's a combination of our self-interest and someone else's. So what makes an outcome just is that it doesn't just stop the conflict. It doesn't just settle the conflict through some form of compromise. It actually resolves the underlying reasons that gave rise to that conflict in the first place. And that's a significant shift in the way that we think about justice. And in order for that to happen, Aristotle is right. We have to take account of the other person's self-interest.
Right.
That has to be included. Well, unfortunately, the law as a mechanism, as a process, consists basically of deciding which of two truths is the correct one. If there is only a single truth, and there is truth versus falsehood, then the law is going to be successful in resolving that dispute. But if it turns out that there are two truths, then trying to decide which one of them is the single truth is going to destroy the complexity of the problem and make it difficult to reach resolution. The only way you get to resolution, then, is by finding a creative combination of those two truths that hopefully turns it into something higher. Here's the example I like to give. There are two ways of combining things. You can take hot water and cold water and add them together and get lukewarm water. Or you can take water and add flour and heat and make bread. And this is what we're looking for, how to make bread. So now let me get to your question. Are there situations in which it is better to experience the conflict and have it continue than to have an outcome which is unjust? And the answer is often. But here's the difficulty. It's never quite so simple. It's much more complex and nuanced. And if what you are asking for and that you consider to be just is something that is just in your self-interest alone, that is not going to be considered just by the other person, and they will then have a reason for refusing to go along. But here's a place where conflict resolution really helps us immensely, and it helps us by helping us recognize that conflict is a relationship, and that means there are always two parts. There are always two truths. There's always more than just one perspective. It is, in fact, our inability to recognize that truth is complex, multi-sided, multi-dimensional, nuanced, that gets us into such difficulty. So we need to ask ourselves, what is the other person's truth that needs to be incorporated in our solution? How do we make bread out of this and not just lukewarm water? Now, there, in terms of examples, once again, there are lots and lots of these, but let me just give one. This is another workplace example where a man was about to be fired by his employer as a security guard at a newspaper. And the reason was because he was so angry all the time, so that the women who worked at this newspaper preferred to walk to their cars through Skid Row alone rather than be accompanied by him. That's how angry he was. So the publisher came and talked about how angry he was and how inappropriate his behavior was and how hostile he was to everyone. And I said to him, is it true that you're angry? He says, damn right. I said, what are you angry about? He says, well, I've been passed over for promotion. It turns out he's like in his late 40s, and he's been passed over by younger people many times. And, of course, the reason is because he's angry all the time. So I said to him, if you were promoted, would you be able to give up your anger? And he said, yeah. I said, well, what kind of job do you feel that you could be promoted to? And it was very funny. He said he wanted to be the head of human resources, which was hysterical because he had more human resource problems than anybody else who worked there. Instead, I turned to the publisher. I said, are there any jobs that are on your desk or other people's desks that you think that he might be able to do? And he said, well, yeah, but I'm not here to give him a promotion. I'm here because he can't deal with his anger. So I said, well, what if we created a situation where it's half of one and half of the other as a transition? So he can imagine moving into this new job and have a reason to give up his anger and at the same time be in his old job and show that he's able to give it up. So they thought that was a kind of interesting idea. So we developed this job description, and he agreed to do it, and the publisher agreed to give him a chance at it. And for 3 months, he would do both jobs. He'd both be the security job and the new job, only he had to have zero anger. But as I'm writing up the agreement, he starts expressing his anger again at the publisher. And being angry about what had happened to him. I said, wait a minute, we've just solved this problem. Why are you still angry? And he says, well, because they did this, they did that. And I said, if you're going to actually make this work, are you going to be able to successfully let go of that anger that you've experienced? And he stopped for a second, and he just said, I don't know. Now, that's the moment of truth. When he says, I don't know. So I said, would you like some help to figure that out? He says, yeah. I said to the publisher, do you have any kind of programs for people that can give them counseling or coaching or therapy? He says, yeah, we've got an employee assistance program. Would you be willing to go through that? Yes. So, okay, let's put this on hold for a little while and give you a chance to go through that program and see what happens. He calls back 2 weeks later and says he's resigning because he's realized how much anger he has from his former life, from the way that he was raised by his parents, from his expectations. He's decided he's going to really go through therapy and work on it, and he's decided he's going to go back to school and get a degree.
Wow.
Now, let's go back to what I was trying to do before. Sounded like a good idea, but it wasn't what he actually needed. I was trying to find a solution that wouldn't have worked for him. He came up with a much better idea eventually, which was to go back to school and get the qualifications that he needed for a better job and to work on his anger in therapy so that he really could get rid of it. So that's an example of a place where a mediated solution wasn't going to produce the highest level of justice for him. And he kind of knew that inside himself. That was an important realization for me to stop and just check in with myself and make sure that I'm really getting the right information from people before jumping to conclusions.
That's great. So Ken and Alyssa, before Alyssa asks her next question, I just wanted to remind people we're near the top of the hour. So we have a number of questions that we've received and comments we've received through the web form. But if you'd like to ask a live question and you're on live call, please go ahead and press *6 in order to be added to the queue. You can also email us a question at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org, or ask a question via the live stream. And with that, Alyssa, I'll let you ask your next question.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Ken, for all the conversation thus far. And, I think one thing I find really interesting is that you gave a couple of different examples. And one thing I noticed, and I think each one of your examples is you note that at one point in the conflict, you really kind of, it sounded like you almost just paused and were really attuned to what was kind of going on within you and trying to sense kind of the vibrations of the conflict and where it was hitting inside you. And so I was wondering if you could speak to some of your personal practices or some of the things that you do to kind of cultivate that awareness and then how that intersects with your professional practice, that's something that I've always been trying to figure out in my own life is how to, you know, cultivate both the inner resources and the outer resources. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Thank you. That's a beautiful question. I'd be happy to. In the first place, I meditate at least an hour every day. And this is really essential because it allows me to, in the first place, I would describe it as filling myself with emptiness, because the emptiness is not a void. It's a place of fullness. But what you are filled with is a kind of sensuousness, if you will, a sensation of how the life energy itself is flowing inside of you. And that gives me information about what is happening with other people, because all of us have the ability to become tuning forks, particularly when it comes to emotion, but also when it comes to storytelling. So every story is a stimulus to empathy. And in fact, they have done functional MRI testing on people who are listening to stories, and highly empathetic people often understand the story in greater detail than it was told in, and reach the end of the story before the storyteller does. A second thing that I do is what I call calibrating my intuition. Intuition is simply the sum total of all of the information that is available to you at any moment that we're not necessarily conscious of. Mm-hmm. And conflict resolution is a highly intuitive methodology. And so what we need to do is to figure out how to access what we know but don't know that we know. And one way of doing that is by tuning yourself to the story and seeing if you can finish it before they do, seeing if you can understand what comes next in the story, if you can feel it arising inside of you. The third thing is what I call the number one rule in conflict resolution, which is to show up. Mm-hmm. And that means as much of you as you can possibly bring to the conversation that you are having in the moment that you are having it. All of you. And if there's any part of you that you can't bring, that's a kind of attachment. And what you want to do then is to take a look at that and see what blocks, what gets in the way. There's another point, which is that every internal blindness results in something that you can't see externally. If there's something you can't see inside yourself, you won't be able to see it outside, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if you've missed something in a conversation, in what someone was trying to tell you, there's some reason why you missed it. And if you focus on it, if you really try to get to the bottom of it, you will become more attuned to parts of yourself, personalities even, that exist inside of you. Good actors are able to do this. And what acting essentially means is that the roles that we act out already exist inside of us in some form. Sometimes they take the form of archetypes, but those archetypes have substance to them. They do have an impact on how people think. There's another part of this, which is following the little trail of breadcrumbs that people leave in their conversations. And I mentioned before about places where there's great depth in the conversation or where there's a peak, like with the word betrayed, for example, or any of the power words, any of the insults, any of the places where people get are highly energized, those are places that have hidden content. And if you just follow those, if you stop in your tracks and figure out what actually happened, you'll be able to do something creative with this. There is another point about this, which is, let's see, how do I say this? I would say that it's important, let's put it this way, it's important to have as much training as you possibly can get, and then it's important to just jump in there. To leap before you look, if you will. You want to do as much looking as you can, but none of the looking is going to help you once you actually make the leap. And to place yourself in a position where you don't know the answer. You couldn't conceivably know the answer. Nobody could know what's going to happen next. And follow it. In order to do that, what you have to first do is to polish your own intention, your attitude, so that it is really impeccable in the sense of being spotless, so that your intention is clear and shines forth, so that people don't have any question about why you're there. They know it's to help them. And that's not a question of faking it, although as the actor George Burns famously said that sincerity is the most important thing in Hollywood, and if you can fake that, you've got it made. but this is something where it just has to be genuine for you. It has to be real. It's not about technique, and it can't be pretense. It's got to be sincerely what you actually want, what you actually mean. And that's, of course, the biggest part.
Yeah, that's wonderful. We have a few questions and reflections that came in off the webcast. But before we turn to those, I just want to use the host prerogative a tiny bit and jump in with where you left off, Ken. It was beautiful to hear about the tools that are important. You talked in the practices. You talked about meditation. You talked about calibrating my intention. You talked about just showing up and so many other things. And I'm wondering, these are obviously tools you've developed over the course of your lifetime and tools for transformation. And I wonder, if you could speak to what was the motivating or what do you think in your life led to your development of these tools? Were there particular stories? Were there particular conflicts? Were there particular things that led you increasingly to go down this path, just in terms of your own personal journey?
Great. Well, I would say there are several things. The first is I would say that I have to give credit to the women in my life for teaching me the importance of emotional intelligence. And I kind of realized, I remember the very first time in junior high school when I realized that girls knew stuff that I didn't. And I couldn't figure out even exactly what it was that they knew. But I was on the phone every night talking to girls who somehow just seemed to have some deep knowledge that was all of a sudden had become important to me, and I wasn't sure what that was. So I would say out of relationships, intimate relationships, has come a lot of learning. The second is the social experience, being in the civil rights movement, as you mentioned, and the anti-war movement and the student movement in the 1960s. I was very much an active participant in that. And I believe in the values that all of those things stood for. But what I realized was that it's a little bit like separating the kids on the playground. You can get a certain distance through demonstration, through confrontation. If what you want to do is to stop people being lynched, that's one way to do it. But if you want to change people's hearts and minds, you have to do something different. That means you have to actually engage them in conversation. We have to be willing to have the dialogues that are important. The third source for me was being a judge and trying to do justice, but somehow not being able to do that, not understanding even how to get there, because the law is so formal. There were two personal experiences that I had. One was an offer to from the governor of California at that time to be appointed to the Superior Court as a judge on the Superior Court. And I had to give the answer the next day, and I was kind of torn about whether to do this or not. And I had a sort of prophetic dream that night where I dreamt that I was on the stand as a judge, and there was this kid who was testifying about some crime he'd committed, and I realized he was lying. And then I looked at the defense counsel, and I realized he was lying too. And I looked at the prosecutor and realized that he was lying. And then I looked at myself, and I saw that I was lying too. And so I got up from the bench in my dream. I took the kid by the hand, sat down on the floor with him, and just said, "Tell me what happened. Tell me who you are." And it was a really intense, powerful dream, and I knew I couldn't do this. So I called and said that I wouldn't the next day. The second major one was that I was appointed to be the first judge on the television program People's Court. So before there was Judge Wapner, there was me, and we did a pilot for the program, in the course of which I mediated the dispute, and I'd done some mediations as a judge, and there wasn't any point in judging it because it was very clear to me that the two people could reach an agreement. And so I got them to a place of agreement, and they were thrilled, and I was fired by the producers because they wanted someone to lose. They wanted there to be victory and defeat. That was one of the important dramatic elements for them. And that was another really important piece of this. But I would say the strongest part of this, do I have time for this? How much more time do I have to answer?
A minute more or so.
Okay. So one of the greatest lessons for me was after I became a mediator and I began doing juvenile victim offender mediations between kids who committed crimes and their victims. And those were just so incredibly powerful and intense. And you realize that, and having been a lawyer who handled criminal cases sometimes, I knew what happened to kids when they went into prison. I'd represented prisoners. And this was just completely different. Nobody went to prison as a result of this. People apologized. They gave retribution and restitution. And there was redemption for the kids as a result of this, not just as a word, as a real thing, because they got to a place where they could pay back for what they had done. And they had to do that in order to be free of it. They had to make themselves whole. Making the victim whole, that's the way that the way it was phrased. But the truth is, it was never as much about the victim as it was about the perpetrator and helping that kid get to a place where they didn't have to walk around covering up their guilt forever with further criminal acts.
Yeah, that's true.
I'd say those are some of the main ones.
That's awesome. Thank you. So I want to turn to some of the questions that have come in. We have Carol that has written in, must people have a true interest in resolution for successful mediation to occur?
No. Here's what I would say probably is characteristic of this. Almost everybody wants to be free of their conflict, and almost nobody wants to come together to talk about it. So they don't have to believe in it. All they have to do is be willing to come together and willing to say what is true for them. And what will happen is that they will discover what is true for them at a deeper level than just the level of how bad they feel about what happened. And that deeper level is, why does this matter to them? Why is this important? So, for example, I do marital mediations. Mm-hmm. And I also do divorce mediations. And in many instances, divorces are places where people just have given up, or they become so exhausted trying to solve the problem that they just can't do it anymore. And one part of every conflict story is the idea that nobody could do anything about this. It's just not possible. Mediation can't possibly work, and I can't tell you how many times I've been told that. And sometimes, truthfully, it doesn't work. Sometimes that's because the mediator may lack the skills. Sometimes it's because it's too deep, it's gone on too long, because people aren't willing to change, because they don't know how to, because they're afraid to. There are thousands of different reasons, but what is most important is that out of this conversation comes some deeper understanding of at least why it is that we actually are stuck. And that's a step forward. Mm-hmm. So I would say no, it's not necessary for people to believe in the process, but it is necessary for them to be able to get in touch with the part of them that doesn't like the conflict at some point.
Great. Thanks. I'm going to turn to our, it looks like we have a live caller in queue, so I'll turn to that person. Let's see. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name's Elisa, and I'm in the Skagit Valley. And I first want to thank you because everything you're saying makes absolute sense to me, and it's wonderful to hear it. And my question is, has this work that you have done helped you with your own conflicts inside yourself?
Oh, my God, yes. Yes, absolutely. One of the really delicious reasons for learning mediation is that you get to work on yourself. In fact, you have to work on yourself. We think of conflicts like we think of a lot of things in the world as external. But the truth is that everything external is processed internally. Even the things that you see, you don't actually, if you break down seeing, light hits your eye and goes through the retina and the fovea and down through the optic nerve into your occipital lobe, and it's translated into images. And it's in a similar type of way, all of the conflicts that we experience internally. So how do you do this? What happens for me is that there, especially earlier in my experience, there would be places where I would get stuck, places where I couldn't figure out what was going on, places where I made mistakes, places where I didn't really understand deeply enough what was going on for someone. And you can't do this work without making those kinds of mistakes. But every single one of those mistakes is one that I take to heart and work on. And then what happens, of course, is that you're busy mediating at work, and then you go home and you discover that you haven't really walked your talk as completely as you ought to have. That there are, you're helping other people do all this work. Well, how about yourself? Aren't there some things that you could do better in your relationships with other people? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And I continue to work on that even today. After all this experience, there are still places where there is something that is upsetting or that strikes me and I'm not completely prepared for it. But what has happened as a result of this work is I now know with great certainty that there is gold in them thou hills, that there's something really valuable, really important that can be learned from this experience. And so my attitude toward it is different. And every time I discover something like this now, I say, fabulous. How great. I've just discovered some place where I can learn something new.
Oh, thank you. And that in itself changes the perception. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you for your question.
Yes, thank you.
We have a question, another one that came into the webcast. It's a two-part question, but I think they're related, so I'll read both of them together. This is from Mish in New York City. Who says, Ken, thank you and grateful for all the learning you're sharing with us today. First, it seems like some seem to thrive on confrontation or conflict, and some shun it. Wondering, where does one's basic nature determine how you handle conflict? Can't it be our nature that determines how we deal with confrontation? And then the second part, which is related, is do you feel that there is a direct correlation between one's aversion to conflict or confrontation and the number of wounded places within?
Ah, beautiful. Okay, so yes. In the first place, we all have a different chemical and genetic makeup. And they've shown with mice that some are more risk-averse than others. Just genetically. Then on top of that, there's what is called epigenetics, which is the influence of environment on genetics, so that what happens in your environment can change the expression of your genes, whether they're turned on or off. So, for example, if you have a male mouse who's subjected to stress, and there's no connection with a female mouse next door except through the air system, so that the odor that comes from the urine of the male mouse is transferred over to the female mouse, the babies that will be born to the female mouse will have higher levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, than for if there's a male mouse that hasn't been subjected to stress. So there's genetic predisposition, there's epigenetic, and there's also, of course, experience. And if it happens once, it's horrible, some trauma. If it happens twice, it's really shattering. And the third time that it happens to you, it becomes really extremely difficult to escape with your life out of whatever it is that has happened. So that's the first piece, is that there is some kind of natural sensitivity that we will have to conflict, and that every one of us can do better at handling as we go through life. Then the second question is about
the first question was about nature and having conflict. The second was correlation between one's aversion to conflict and the number of wounded places.
Yes, exactly. So the more wounds that you've experienced, the more your threshold for pain has been altered. And the more sensitive you are to, like, if you stub your toe, you're going to go around stubbing your toe quite frequently. I think it's just kind of on that level. But basically, there's a way in which that lets us off the hook, and I don't want to do that. So what is important to say in spite of that is that there are still things that can be done. Here's my approach to what happens when there is what I call catastrophic suffering. And one of the things that I teach is forgiveness, and it's also something that I work on. Forgiveness as a spiritual practice, and also as a form of conflict resolution. And instead of letting someone off the hook who's experienced something terrible, instead something is demanded of them. They are what they have uniquely available to them is the ability to dedicate some part of their lives to making sure that no one suffers the way that they did. And everybody who has really suffered will instantly recognize the truth of this. This is their way out. Instead of pretending that somehow you can go on with your life and everything will be okay, you have been given a kind of gift. It wasn't a gift you wanted. It wasn't a gift that you would even necessarily choose. But once it has been given, the choice is what to do with it. And if you can turn it into something that becomes a gift to others, rather than passing the suffering on to others or denying the suffering, that's the path that leads to the greatest growth. And that becomes possible in conflict resolution, especially with kids who've committed crimes, people who have experienced great trauma in their lives. And one of the things in Mediators Beyond Borders, we have a project in Rwanda that is using what is called trauma-informed mediation, because everybody in Rwanda has been traumatized, and there are conflicts in which people get re-traumatized. And so we're combining mediation and trauma professionals and teaching both sets of skills simultaneously. And that's the second approach to this. We need to be deeply respectful of suffering and not blame the victim for what has happened. But having said that, we also need to say to them, there is something that you uniquely can contribute to the rest of us that none of the rest of us can. People who've gone through war, in the Middle East, there's an organization called Combatants for Peace, and it consists of the members of the Israeli Defense Force, Hamas, Fatah, Islamic Jihad, etc., all of them former fighters who had fought against each other, coming together to say, this isn't going to work. We've got to do something different. Nobody can say that like they can, just like nobody could produce peace in Northern Ireland other than the IRA and the Ulster Constabulary. They were the ones who did it. And it was out of their suffering and out of their pain that that peace process came to realization.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Ken. There's been so much in this conversation that's been rich. I mean, just a few things that jump out at me, and there's just so many, your statements that in every conflict, there's a wounded part of us that's seeking relief. How, as a society, in some ways, we're still in that transition between parallel play to cooperative play. How every story in some ways is an opportunity for empathy. And, you know, there's just so much that you talked about, like the ways in which we will keep being presented with increasing levels of conflict as we continue to develop tools for transcendence and transformation, and how every conflict is really that opportunity, and it gives us the little learning arrows towards those skills we need to learn in order to move toward higher order conflicts. So thank you for that amazing insight. There's so many more questions I personally have. Hope to be able to find ways to continue the conversation with you with our whole ecosystem in the future. But as we close, I just want to ask you one question, which is that how can we as a larger service-based community support your work?
Actually, if we can describe it as our work, here's my belief about this. As globally, we are now facing problems that can no longer be solved using law or military force or even ordinary forms of diplomacy. We require something new. And I believe that what we have to do as a species is to figure out how to solve our problems collaboratively and in ways that don't make any of us into enemies. And it's very easy to do that. It's easy to do it with North Korea. It's happening right now with Iran, with Russia. And I would say that the most important thing for us to do is to resist the notion that some one of us is the enemy. My way of saying this is more or less the following. All of these are conflicts between them and us. But we have to get to a point where we realize there is no them. There's just us. That's all there is. It's just us. And when we realize that, we begin to move in the direction of dialogue and conflict resolution and communication. And that's what we have to figure out how to do as a species. So whatever it is that people do, that will be terrific. You can support organizations like Mediators Beyond Borders or Partners for Democratic Change or Essential Partners, which does dialogue work. There are there are a number of organizations that are out there. And I would say to help turn our political process in a conflict resolution and dialogue direction. Mm-hmm. If we can do that, we will have done something really amazing.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, in gratitude to your insights today, I invite everyone to hold a collective 1 minute of silence, and then after the silence, we'll open up the lines and kind of do a collective shout-out of gratitude to you. So on 1, 2, 3, let's all say our collective thank you to Ken. So 1, 2, 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.